My guest today is Munira Mirza, Director of Arts and Culture to the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson. Like her boss, and like the life that she's chosen, Munira is a paradox. Among the notable institutions she's worked for are the Tate, the Royal Society of Arts, and the think tank Policy Exchange. She's also a founding member of the Manifesto Club, which campaigns against the hyper-regulation of everyday life. Munira has chosen as her great life the 20th century political theorist Hannah Arendt, a woman whose life, personal and professional, has been riven by controversy. Munira, why did you choose Hannah Arendt as your great life?
I chose her because she's one of the most important public intellectuals of the 20th century, and her writings on totalitarianism really, I think, shaped a whole generation of thinkers and certainly influenced my own writing. But I also chose her because I thought that she was a very brave woman, and she was brave in what she said and did. She always did what she thought was the right thing rather than what was popular, what was safe. So whether it was helping Jewish refugees escape Nazi Germany in the 1930s or whether it was when she was writing in America in the 60s and 70s, I think she always had an integrity, and I admire her a great deal for that.
You said that she was an absolutely seminal 20th century thinker. Sum up an idea of hers that made a huge difference.
Well, I think central to all her writing is the importance of making judgments, and making judgments regardless of the political or social pressures. And when she wrote about totalitarianism, her main argument was that totalitarianism had discouraged people from thinking for themselves. And she had said, actually quite controversially, that the evil of the Nazis and the evil of Stalinist Russia was not that people individually were evil or psychopathic, but that they had lost the capacity to make a moral judgment about what was right and wrong because of the society in which they lived. So she was a great defender of freedom.
And as a German Jew living in New York, where did she stand on cultural pluralism and all that sort of thing?
Well, it's very interesting because I think that she wrote partly based on her own experience as someone who was a stateless person, but with a great affection and love of the German culture and German language. And I think that her understanding of the kind of stateless person in America was that as long as you had political freedom, as long as you could engage in argument and discussion, you could feel at home, you could feel like you belonged somewhere. She believed in this ideal that there may be cultural differences between people, but they can transcend those by coming together through argument and political debate.
I ask because you wrote quite a controversial work, Living Apart Together, British Muslims and the Paradox of Multiculturalism. In a sense, you were taking to Muslim society in Britain some of the ideas that Hannah Arendt was taking to the different cultural groups within American society, the idea that they should be part of the larger whole.
I think, yes. I mean, I certainly have been influenced by her. And the argument that I've always made about Muslims or any minority group in society is that it's important to be willing to open oneself up to debate and discussion. And so I've never believed that there should be censorship about religious hatred or religious disagreement. I've always thought that it's the best thing for Muslims, actually, to be open to criticism and debate from external sources and internally. And Arendt herself, who had many things to say about the Jewish community and Jewish leadership, also spoke very honestly about what she thought were the problems of America and of the Jewish question in Europe.
And it got her into a lot of trouble with some fellow Jews. Has your stand got you into trouble with fellow Muslims?
Yes, there have been criticisms of the things that I've said, but that hasn't stopped me from wanting to express them because I fundamentally, I think that it's right to be honest about these very important issues. But I don't think I've experienced anything at the level that Hannah experienced when she was very critical of certain things in the Jewish community.
To help us better understand the life of Hannah Arendt, we're joined by Dr. Leon Botstein, president of Bard College, New York. Leon was a student of Arendt's and came to know her well as a friend. He's on the line from the Radio Foundation in Manhattan, the city that became home to our great life after she was forced to flee Europe in 1941. Leon, you knew Hannah. What was she like as a person? What were your first impressions of her? Give us a word picture of the woman.
I met her really because I heard her speak when I was a first-year college student, and she actually spoke in defense of her book on Eichmann and her reporting of the Eichmann trial. She was so magnetic. You know, she's a good argument why women particularly should not be concerned about aging if they have character. She required no plastic surgery or cosmetics. The vibrancy for a young person like myself of a woman then in her 60s, was so palpable, and you could actually see her think. It was as if you had the back of a watch with a crystal, so you could see all the wheels moving. So she was a magnetic, charismatic personality with a very distinctive voice, always a cigarette in her hand, and truly a commanding presence.
I want to come back in a little while to that incredibly important book, Eichmann, in Jerusalem, The Banality of Evil, an argument that I think she has won. But let's start from the beginning. Where was she born? When was she born? And what was her background?
She was born in 1906 in Hanover and was brought up in a middle-class Jewish home, sufficient to propel her to seek higher education in a very sophisticated manner as part of her own career, her ambition to be a writer and to be a thinker, and which led her to study ultimately with Martin Heidegger and later with Jaspers. She was interested in politics and philosophy, the intersection between politics and philosophy.
Was she a secular Jew or
did totally she... secular? Mm. Totally secular. In other words, I think she was oriented, but I never had the impression that she had anything more than a basic orientation. So German was really her language. She was definitely absolutely convinced that her identity as a Jew was central to who she was. And as Munira pointed out, for her, speech was and ought to be a form of political action. She believed that a human being could only flourish if they were citizens. So it was not only being able to argue, it was the position from which one could argue. So America was idealized because it offered citizenship without one having to have been born there.
And yet, Munira, for all her Jewishness and for all her adoption of America, you said that she was passionate about German culture, German language.
Yes, she was incredibly well-read from a very young age. And there's one point, I think, when she was 16, she admitted that she'd read Goethe and Kant and Kierkegaard, which is quite an impressive reading list for a teenager. But she took that love of language all the way through her life. And even when, after the war and after the horror of the Holocaust was revealed, she did not denounce Germany and German culture per se, because she said at one point it wasn't the language that went crazy. So she always had a love of the language, and she wrote poetry. I don't believe she experienced anti-Semitism in such an acute way as she did when she was much older. So for her, I think she grew up feeling very German.
And secure.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't quite totally agree with it. I think she knew very well that she was Jewish. It was impossible to grow up in the 20s and after the First World War in Germany without a daily recognition that you were Jewish. This is an erasure of memory. Certainly things got very much worse as the 20s wore on. And that was not incompatible with a love of the German language and not incompatible with the notion that this culture is not owned by a segment of the population. And for her, I think she was very resistant, especially after the controversy of the Eichmann book, to talk about her relationship to cultural entities, Jews, Germans, Muslims. And she said in a letter, Gershom Scholem, you know, she doesn't love people in general. She loves individuals. And so for her, no one could steal the language of her birth and self-expression.
I think that's right. And when she was younger, she didn't deny her Jewishness. And at one point, she tells of a story where her mother had told her that when she was at school, if her teachers made anti-Semitic remarks, she was to stand up immediately and complain about it to the authorities. But if another child had made an anti-Semitic remark about her, she was to defend herself. And so I think she grew up, like you said, with a very keen understanding that anti-Semitism existed. But I think it was not really something that affected her in her early life as much as it would have much later. I don't think Hannah internalized the anti-Semitism of German culture.
You're absolutely right. That's the seminal point, because the difficulty of being Muslim or Jewish as a minority, is the possibility that you'll internalize the image of yourself that's negative that the others put on you. And therefore, you either hide from the fact of your own identity, or you attempt to camouflage it, or you attempt to be something you're not. So the interesting thing is that Hannah, in her family, did develop a pride in who she was without having to adhere either to religious or cultural stereotypes.
Tell me, Monera, about the relationship with the philosopher Martin Heidegger. How old was she?
I think she was very young, and he was almost twice her age. So I'm sure that she was captivated by him and by his superiority. He wrote later about how she had been a huge influence on his work on Being in
Time. It was a full-scale affair, wasn't it? Not just a...
No, it certainly was. It wasn't just a fling. And the controversy, of course, is that Heidegger became a member of the Nazi Party and for a long time didn't disavow Nazi principles. And the thing that was most controversial about her, I imagine, is not so much that she'd had the fling, but that she had resumed the friendship after the war. And I think that's because she fundamentally distanced her own feelings about him and took his philosophy, which is still regarded as incredibly significant for the 20th century. Existentialism, the kinds of things that he was writing are still being studied in universities today. She was also very critical of him. There are letters between her and Jaspers where she criticises Heidegger for being self-indulgent and for being indulged by the circle of people around him. And really, her criticism of Heidegger was a criticism of Western philosophy in general, which is that it was so removed from human reality, it had become so esoteric, that it had failed to understand what was actually going on in Germany at the time.
What I think is so interesting about all of this is that no one would assess a person's life and career by their sexual behavior between the ages 18 and 21. No male intellectual figure has ever been brought on trial in public opinion because between the ages of 18 and 21 they slept with someone who was finally turned out to be a criminal.
Monera, you presented a series for Radio 4 called The Business of Race, in which you looked at the effects that pointing out and pointing up cultural differences can have on society. Hannah Arendt was from a Jewish culture, but born a German citizen. How did she cope with the growth of anti-Semitism in Germany while she was still there? How did she react?
With great bravery, I think. She knew that she couldn't bury her head in the sand, and even when her colleagues, even when Jaspers actually was being dismissive of the Nazis, she sensed a greater threat. And in 1933, she joined various Zionist groups and became very actively involved in helping Jewish refugees escape and helping political dissidents escape.
And that was physically brave as well as intellectually.
She certainly was. She was arrested, actually. And very, very fortunately, she was released after 8 days by a policeman who took kindly upon her. I think she was very aware of the possibilities of Nazi Germany and what that would mean for her. So even though she had not thought of her Judaism as being central to her identity before then, she did respond to it as a Jew. And her interest in politics really was as a Jew being persecuted. And she was always quite clear about that, I think.
How did she get to America, Leon?
Well, she went through Paris, but the important story that's just been told underscores that for her, the identity of being a Jew was a national identity, not a religious one. The Jew was a dispersed nation where political membership had been denied in other places, which is why she was attracted to Zionism. Also, this perception that anti-Semitism and the Nazis were not to be dismissed later found its intellectual echo in the fact that the origins of totalitarianism opens really with a section on the importance of anti-Semitism in the history of the modern European arena. She went to Paris and from Paris then emigrated to the United States, to New York. So I think that she had a different kind of Zionism, which wanted to achieve the almost unachievable. She wanted a political framework so Jews could become normal. And part of being normal was, among other things, having an army. So she thought that self-defense and taking charge of one's own life was essential. She believed in a Jewish homeland. She greatly disapproved of the way the Arab population was treated from the point of view of the right-wing Zionists, and she was not fond of the political compromise that Ben-Gurion and Weizmann ended up with in 1948.
You're listening to Great Lives, and my guest today is the Mayor of London's arts advisor, Munira Mirza, who's chosen the 20th century political theorist Hannah Arendt as her great life. And we're joined from New York by Hannah's devoted friend, the college president who knew her since he was 16. Munira, we're sort of trying to reconcile different sides of Hannah Arendt's character as though there was a unifying theory. She did believe in the importance of accepting and celebrating your own culture. At the same time, she seems to have thought it was quite important that you didn't get tied down by your own culture and that you felt yourself to be part of a larger humanity. I'd put it to you that there isn't actually a unifying theory. These were just two completely different arguments struggling in the breast of somebody who must have experienced the strength of both arguments through her own personal circumstances. And there's an inherent contradiction between the two.
No, I think her approach might seem contradictory at first, but actually it does make sense. And what she does in her writings, I think, is recognise these different aspects of human behaviour and identity. She recognises that people come from a place and that in the social reality that people are treated differently. In society, people are treated differently. They have different cultures, they have different languages. The difference that Hannah Arendt draws is between the authority of people to decide for themselves and then the state. And her fundamental criticism of totalitarianism is that the state, as an authority, makes decisions about people's personal lives. She was a great advocate of civil liberties, and I'm sure she would have been horrified that the state would now start telling people how to bring up their children or what to eat or what to say and think. And that's the concern that she has. So I think that what she does, which is very intelligent and very nifty, is that she recognises that human beings live in both the private sphere but also the public sphere, and that there are differences in the way that we interact in those different realms.
But the oppression of the state, Leon, she was against, clearly. But what about the oppression of one's own culture, the oppression of one's own family, the oppression of the place, as Munira puts it, that you're coming from?
I think she was at the core sort of a child of the Enlightenment, of the notion of individuality. Her idealized political state was drawn from a picture of the Athenian polis, of the Greek polis, where speech and debate are the reigning instruments of politics, and where the individual is essentially secular, where the question of being religious or being of a culture is so adapted by the individual that there isn't this kind of reductive definition of being Muslim, being Jewish, being English, being French. What we now call identity politics would have been obnoxious to her. She believed in the creative power of the individual, which is why she admired artists and why she admired philosophers and poets. And so it was for her really the power of the human imagination to take the roots from which you come and then really cultivate a self which is an invention of the powers of intellect and creativity.
Yes, in the realms of the imagination, the realms of human creativity and thought, I can see the power of that argument, but it will eventually lead you in practical politics into real conflict.
Not if you make politics about the equality of citizenship, therefore the processes of democracy that have nothing to do with what race or ethnicity or language even you speak.
Tell us a bit, Munira, about that book, and especially that amazing phrase, The Banality of Evil, the book about Eichmann that got her into such trouble.
Adolf Eichmann, who was regarded as the architect of the war crimes, the genocide that the Nazis perpetrated, was arrested in Argentina and was brought to trial in Israel. And Hannah Arendt went to the New Yorker magazine and asked to cover the trial in a series of articles, and she wanted to go over to Israel and follow the trial, and eventually she ended up writing a book of her observations. And the phrase that she coined, The Banality of Evil, really was about Eichmann himself and what he symbolised. What was really striking to her was that Eichmann was a bureaucrat, and he came up with all these sort of trite phrases during the trial about how he was just doing his job, and actually he quite liked some Jews, and the things that he was saying did not to her seem like the psychopathic killer that she and other people had been led to believe. So she coined this phrase, banality of evil, to say that the most terrifying thing about Nazi Germany was not that people were evil in any conventional sense, but that they were actually following the law. They thought that they were doing the right thing.
I think what was powerful about the book was the notion of a distinction between what we would like to think of as radical evil, you know, the people who do these terrible things are different from ourselves. The use of bureaucracy, the use of linguistic devices, law, circumlocution, so you don't call something what it really is, but you give it another kind of name, made something that was completely horrible, the mass murder of people, as banal as shipping crates, as separating oranges, as delivering pork bellies. It's simply lost all of its sense of the sanctity of human life.
That had been, I suppose, Leon, her first famous book, written more than 10 years before the Eichmann book, The Origins of Totalitarianism. What did it say?
She described the system by which politics and the state took over the functions of controlling the life of the private sphere and eliminate freedom, and essentially where the state and a party become singular. And she connected the two totalitarian regimes, that of Hitler and Stalin, with the course of European history from the late 18th century. And the most important factors in her mind were race thinking and anti-Semitism and imperialism. So she described the origins of these two monstrous systems that were responsible for making decency an act of heroism, where the state and the party apparatus and the ideology of defining the other and exterminating peoples and creating a racialist ideology, these successful efforts on the part both of Hitler and Stalin need to be explained from a historical and explanatory point of view.
It's interesting, actually, because one of the things that is so striking about Hannah is that she doesn't fit into categories of left and right very easily. And the right often criticised her for being too sympathetic to Marxism, reading too much historical materialism, but the left criticised her for being too conservative. And what she did with Origins of Totalitarianism and her later writing was that she said that both Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany had common features. And the point that she was making, and obviously making it in the context of the information that she had at the time about Soviet Russia, obviously we know a lot more now about that state, but she was arguing that freedom was really the defining issue of the 20th century, and that that was something that didn't make sense simply in the categories of left and right. That wasn't the only way in which she could understand that problem. So I think that actually as a writer, she confused people because she didn't follow a party, she didn't have a label, and she really was her own person.
Have you found, Munira, in your own political and cultural career that it's always awkward when you refuse to fit neatly into one camp or another?
There is a confusion about what is left and right today, and I don't fit easily under a label and don't particularly want to right now, because it's very difficult to understand lots of the problems we have today through those categories. And I suppose I'm attracted to her humanism and to the importance that she places on freedom and humans being able to act and judge for themselves. And probably to me the most important political issues that we face today are about our freedom, which is why I've been involved in political campaigns to campaign for free speech or reducing the impact of the state, the intrusion of the state in our everyday life.
You stayed friends with her, Leon, right to the end. We've been talking about her as a thinker and idealist and debater and all the rest, but to you she was also a personal friend.
She loved the arts. She wrote wonderful essays on writers and on literature and on poetry. And she did not consider painting, music, and literature decorative, something not necessary in the public realm. So she was one of the last great intellectuals for whom the arts were more than entertainment.
Would you like to have met her, Munira, in those last years? And do you think you'd have found her in an optimistic frame of mind about the future?
I often think now I would like to have her wisdom, her insight near me when I'm looking at political problems or political issues. So I would have very much enjoyed meeting her.
My thanks to my guests today, Dr. Munira Mirza, cultural advisor to the Mayor of London, and Dr. Leon Botstein, president of the Bard College. Goodbye.